Support for this episode of Talking Machines comes from Baidu Research.
You are listening to Talking Machines. I'm Catherine Gorman.
And I'm Ryan Adams.
And today, Ryan, we're going to talk about NIPS and some of the workshops that are going on.
Yeah, so the Neural Information Processing Systems Conference, or NIPS, is one of the premier machine learning venues. And it has a couple different components to it, if you've never been before. It has the tutorial session, which is usually the first day. And that has the main conference session with sort of one big single track and then poster sessions. And then the last 2 days of the conference are dedicated to workshops. Mm. Now, each of these is interesting in its own way, and you can go and see who the great tutorial speakers are this year, and you can go and see all the different accepted papers and so on. But the workshops, I think, are really interesting for getting insight into kind of what's on people's mind. You know, often, papers are written pretty far in advance, and they're sort of the result of a longer trajectory of work. And so they don't necessarily reflect exactly what's on somebody's mind sort of today. Whereas workshops are interesting because at the workshops, you'll see sort of half-baked things, or you'll see sort of work that is, it's a little bit, it's just earlier on. And then the workshops themselves are often themed in ways that reveal sort of people's thought processes. And it's often really interesting to kind of see what different people in the community feel like represents a sort of coalescing research direction. And so, and often this is revealed interestingly in the title. So you can look through the list, and I think what's interesting is to get a sense of what the different themes are in any given year. And it's clear that there's, every year there's a kind of theme of machine learning for X, where X is some interesting application domain. Here you can immediately see that there's a few workshops about doing machine learning for experimental physics, machine learning for neuroimaging, for healthcare, for adaptive user interfaces, and other interesting areas. So there's always a well-represented set of people who care about particular application domains and their interfaces with machine learning. Something I'm seeing here this year is there's a lot of interest in approximate inference, perhaps more than there has been in the past. For example, there's the advances in approximate Bayesian inference, which I think is a workshop sort of focused on innovative new ideas in variational inference and Bayesian models. There's ABC in Montreal, where ABC stands for approximate Bayesian computation, which is not the same exactly as approximate Bayesian inference. Approximate Bayesian computation is dealing with big probabilistic models where it's very expensive to evaluate the likelihood. And then we also see there's a workshop on probabilistic integration. Integration is one of the things we spend a lot of time doing in Bayesian computation. So this is kind of a different view on that, trying to take advantage of sort of modern probabilistic numerics to do integration, that being different from these other approaches to sort of Bayesian inference. And so right away, we can see that there's at least five or six workshops that are kind of about variations on doing inference in probabilistic models. So clearly, people are excited about that this year. So the other theme that you can immediately see, and this is kind of always a persistent theme, is thinking about optimization. So there's the optimization for machine learning workshop. There's also this very interesting sort of bounded optimality and meta reasoning, rational meta reasoning workshop that I think is sort of at least sort of at first glance looks like it's thinking about how to incorporate the cost of inference and optimization within machine learning. There's also a Bayesian optimization workshop thinking about how to do sort of high level optimization of hard functions, as well as a non-convex optimization for machine learning workshop, which I think is kind of focusing on some of the exciting new, for example, tensor decomposition methods for doing machine learning. So, you know, there are more workshops than any person could expect to attend, and so many exciting things going on, and I've only touched on just a few here, and so sorry if I didn't mention yours, but you can definitely see some emerging themes, people thinking creatively about different kinds of optimization methods, lots of interest in approximate Bayesian inference in different settings, and exciting different application areas where people are trying to really use these methods to make a difference in different scientific domains.
If you're interested in the workshops at NIPS, we'll have a link on our website, thetalkingmachines.com. Today's listener question is about number of features.
Hello, my name is Alexander. I am a high school student from Bulgaria. Recently, I started studying machine learning, and I'm seriously considering pursuing it in college. My question is about using data that has a small number of features to make predictions about data that has a large number of features. For example, an image recognition system that we train it by giving it a data set with low resolution images and then feeding it high resolution images and expect to get accurate results, but without tampering with the features of the images themselves, literally having a larger number of features as input. If such a system is possible, maybe by the same logic, we can generalize NP problems. Because in NP problems, it's fairly easy to generate data when n is small. But as n gets larger, it gets exponentially more difficult. So, is it possible to design a system like that?
Thanks for the question, Alexander. You know, there's a lot to think about here. And so I think I'll sort of maybe map this into a couple of different things. So one of them is, you know, how do we take situations in which we have sort of a coarse-grained representation of our data and use that to get better at situations in which we have fine-grained representations of the data? This is something that interests people quite a lot. And in fact, there's been, I just mentioned NIPS workshops. A couple of years ago, there was a workshop on learning from coarse to fine-grained data, exactly kind of like this. The question is, how do we share information from the coarse-grained problem to the fine-grained problem? So you can imagine tackling this in a couple of different ways. One really natural thing is to imagine that what we're going to do is try to find a representation of the coarse-grained data that is shared with the representation of the fine-grained data. So then what we hope is by having a bunch of low-dimensional data, we find a good representation, and that representation sort of warm starts what we need for the harder problem. And so you can, and so if we believe, as you say, for example, in the case where we have high and low resolution images, that the representation that underlies these should be fundamentally similar, we might hope to be able to make a lot more progress on the hard problem based on the solution to the easy problem. There's also another twist on this kind of thing, which is the idea of an attention mechanism. So one of the ways you might imagine thinking about this is in human vision, where we have a small region of high resolution, kind of our fovea, right in the middle of our field of view, and then there, we have a large sort of peripheral area that's relatively low resolution. And the way that as humans and sort of primates, we wield this fovea is by using our sort of low resolution vision in some way to build maybe a coarse grain model of the world. And then we have some kind of policy for foveating, for moving our eyes to areas that are important for gathering information about our environment and using then that high resolution information to sort of build a better model when it's important. And so there's been a lot of effort in machine learning to try to build in attentional models of various kinds, where perhaps you have some very high dimensional representation of the data. It could be something like a big image, but perhaps it's even like a video, or maybe it's a large text document, or even an environment or something that you can navigate. And the question is, how do you come up with a policy for gathering very kind of weak information at sort of a coarse level, and then use that to decide what high resolution information you're going to gather. So this is something that gets that's getting sort of, no pun intended, more attention in the literature as people feel like the data are becoming richer, and perhaps the sort of scaling properties of our models don't necessarily keep up all the time. And so you'd like to be more intelligent about how to gather the sort of features to actually inspect. Now, then you talked also a little bit about how this might make progress on sort of NP hard problems. And I guess I don't quite understand exactly what connection you're drawing here, but we could imagine that, but there is this area of trying to find sort of approximate solutions to different kinds of NP problems. Or let's just call them very hard computation problems, since rather than sort of diving into the technical details, where you know you have some situation where computing a quantity might be arbitrarily hard. One example that I really like is computing the permanent of a matrix, which is sharp p, but there are turn out to be efficient algorithms for approximating that in polynomial time. And there's other kinds of examples like this as well. So, for example, and within machine learning, there's k-means clustering, where most often, you know, we use Lloyd's algorithm, this kind of iterative procedure to find the means and the assignments in k-means. In general, we know that the finding the true solution of k-means is very, very hard. But there are interesting approximation algorithms, in particular, the k-means plus plus algorithm that gives you a randomized solution to k-means that can be proven to sort of be quite close in practical terms to the global solution of k-means. So this kind of attack on different kinds of computationally hard problems, I think, is a very promising one, and is something that the sort of theoretical computer science community and its interface with machine learning spends a lot of time thinking about. There's this notion, for example, of fully polynomial time randomized approximation schemes that take advantage of randomness, as does k-means++, and as does this sort of permanent approximation algorithm that I mentioned. You know, they use some kind of notion of randomness to find a solution and prove that it, with high probability, it's going to be close to the true best solution. So I don't necessarily, at least in my mind, I don't view the sort of coarse to fine grained kind of machine learning as being all that related to these algorithms. But that's not to say that in the future that we won't find sort of interesting and deep connections between them. So thanks for the question.
If you've got a question for Talking Machines, you can reach us at thetalkingmachines@gmail.com or tweet us at TLKNGMCHNS. Today's guest on Talking Machines is Adam Kalai of Microsoft Research New England. When we got a chance to sit down with him, we started with the first question that we always start with. How did you get where you are?
Okay, well, I started graduate school at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, which was and is a great center of machine learning. When I was there back in the late 90s and early 2000s, they had self-driving cars. They had a lot of cool things. I chose CMU because they have a very nurturing environment where they encourage the students to try working on different things, different areas. And it's a great time in graduate school to explore working on different things. And also, once you're a tenured professor, I imagine it's also a great time to explore working on things. So that's your big opportunity. And so I did that. I started working in theoretical computer science, where you prove theorems about you design algorithms and prove theorems about their analysis and their running times. And then I moved. I worked in a virtual reality lab. Okay, where you wear these...
That's a huge jump.
Yeah, you wear these head-mounted displays and you see things in three dimensions. But actually, I found that didn't come as easily to me as it did to some other people, or as easily as proving theorems did. So I was nervous and I went back to proving theorems, which I loved. It was really fun analyzing algorithms, and you could prove theorems about machine learning algorithms and artificial intelligence. So I really enjoyed that. And then I actually tried again a second time. I tried working on 3D displays that you could look at without glasses. Kind of random things. I bopped around a lot in graduate school, but ultimately I settled back into theoretical machine learning. So I spent maybe 10 years working in that. And then at some point I said, screw it. And I said, you know, I'm going to go try working on something different. And around the same time, actually, something came up called crowdsourcing, which you've all heard about. Anyone who travels actually is seeing the world changing with Uber and, you know, the sharing economy. You're taking Uber instead of taxi, or you're staying in an Airbnb instead of a hotel. And so crowdsourcing is having a huge impact on machine learning as well, or has a potentially huge impact. Largely right now, people are using it to label data.
Well, tell us how crowdsourcing works.
In crowdsourcing, you can appeal to a large group of people. You can put out a call and say, hey, can anyone help me with this? It can be paid, can be in the form of a game, in a number of ways. But one of the most popular platforms now is something called Mechanical Turk, which Amazon runs, and you can very quickly pay people to do any kind of online task that you want. There's analogs in the real world where you can hire people to do things in the real world, but on Mechanical Turk, you can hire them to do anything, and they're typically at a desktop behind a browser, anything they can do that way. So it's made labeling data and running experiments very, very efficient.
Well, I mean, what kind of experiments?
You can run psychology experiments. So a lot of academia has been trying to show that you can reproduce classical studies that were done in the lab with graduate students, say, online with crowdsourcing on these platforms, and they've been largely successful if you know how to to run the experiments properly.
So like what kind of experiments might you ask a grad student to do?
Good. So, I mean, as I mentioned, typically, well, a classic example would be, you know, here's an image, label it. So a lot of people have images that
like
they
label
want.
It with a with an
with
object.
Words okay. With words. What's in the image? There's a man. There's a bike. Things like that for computer vision research. That's very useful, and that's sort of one of the early examples. But then people do it for use it for psychology experiments to understand how people think, things like that. Or you might just have data and you say, yeah, draw a box around the faces. If you're doing computer vision, again, draw a box around the faces, annotate these videos, things like that. I'm interested. I think that crowdsourcing can be used to do much more. So I think you can use crowdsourcing to really understand, get a better representation of the data. So a secret of machine learning is that the representation, the way you represent your data is crucial, and that can have a bigger effect than the specific choice of the algorithm. And humans have a certain representation of the data in their head, which often is better or different than the machines. So if we can use crowdsourcing to get a handle on that representation, then we can design better algorithms. And we can design algorithms that are more useful to people because the way they interact, if they're trying to search a store for a product or get a recommendation for something, the way they understand that space of products is very important if you want to give them a good recommendation.
So, you know, I think of crowdsourcing, particularly through something like Mechanical Turk, as being, essentially what you do is create a very kind of simple choice for the users to make. You essentially make like a web page where they maybe make a binary decision, mm-hmm. you know, which one of these images is a cat?
Right.
Or, you know, which one of these looks better, or like rank these things from 1 to 10 or so on. Like very simple kind of choices that don't depend on any particular domain knowledge. Right. And then you pay them kind of 5 cents to make that choice and hopefully sift through the people who are just doing a bad job while they're watching TV or whatever.
Right.
So what you've said here is really interesting, which is extracting much more sophisticated knowledge from them.
Right.
Can you talk about how you can map that into a problem that like a Mechanical Turker can do?
Sure. So there's multiple ways to do that. One way is to ask them to do this simple kind of binary task and then use statistics to find the interesting representation behind the scenes. And the other way is to give them, to ask them more interesting questions. So for example, let me give you an example. So if you want to represent data, there's multiple ways to represent it. One way is to embed it in space, so a Euclidean embedding. An easy way to think about that is, say you had a bunch of images of faces, you could imagine laying them out on a piece of paper in two dimensions, right? And you could put maybe the men on the left and the women on the right and separate it by race vertically. If you had a third dimension, you could use that for hair length and so on. And computers aren't limited to just three dimensions, so you could, of course, represent it in high dimensions. So how do you get that representation from people? And the goal, by the way, with these representations is so that nearby points are similar. So there might be other things like a smirk or a certain facial expression which makes two faces similar, which wouldn't be a special dimension, but you would want nearby faces, you would want two people with similar expressions to maybe be close in Euclidean space. So how do you get that from the crowd, right? So if you're in a domain where you don't really need a special expertise like faces or annotating images, you can just take people who are watching TV, it's fine. and you show, so what we did in the first experiment is we showed them three images. On top we'd have image A, on the bottom we'd have X and Y, and we'd say which of X or Y is more similar to A. And it's just a binary choice. They have to answer one of those, even if they don't have a strong opinion. And we wanted their gut reaction. It worked great. A person could go through hundreds of images like that in minutes. We could get many different people's opinions, which actually turns out to be very valuable. Even though you'd think it'd be confusing to have different people with different opinions, that can actually give you better representation. So using that, when you get these, well, there's a few questions here. One of the questions is, how do you choose which questions to ask? And so our system uses active learning to intelligently select which questions to ask. And by doing that, we can save a lot of human effort.
So, I mean, so can you talk a little bit more about what things you tend to discover? So the idea, so what does it mean to be good at this problem such that you could use active learning?
Right. So a good embedding is one which captures the human representation accurately. And you also want to get a good embedding by asking few questions, because people have to put in the effort and you have to pay dollars in order to get this good embedding. So essentially, you would like to be able to predict. Ultimately, if you had a really good understanding of the space, you would be able to answer this question of, for any three images, which of two are more similar to the first. And you would like to get that understanding by asking as few questions as possible. So given a bunch of representation, given a bunch of answers to these questions, the way to transform this into an embedding is called multidimensional scaling. So that's a classic problem where you're given a bunch of judgments from humans and you want to embed points in space. And we developed some algorithms for that that are suited for this kind of very noisy crowdsourcing environment. And then, as I said, we had an intelligent algorithm for choosing among these possible questions. If there's n object, there's n choose three possible choices. There's a lot of choices you could make. And so we have an intelligent algorithm for doing that. I won't go into the details of it, but for example, with faces, you do get kind of you do get what you expect, where you sort of have men on the right and women on the left, or in, you know, divided by some line. Another example of what we did is a fun data set is we didn't expect it to work on this data set, but we actually gave people the letters of the alphabet, A through Z. Okay, we asked them, lowercase, you know, lowercase letters, is lowercase C more like lowercase E or lowercase T? What a weird question. Do you think you'll get any useful, you know, answers from that kind of thing? And so we didn't know, but it turned out that our representation was actually quite good. So some people would answer that question by saying, well, C is more like E because they're both short letters, or they're both close to each other in the alphabet. And other people would say, well, C is more like T because they're both consonants. So you'd have all these different answers. They weren't telling us why, but we could ask them afterwards what they were thinking. And then in the embedding, you could actually see that there was a separation between these different features. So there was a line separate, or in high dimensions, a hyperplane separating the vowels from the consonants, or a direction in which the letters were essentially ordered almost alphabetically, and things like that. So we knew that our experiments were working. And we built a fun little prototype, which we could use to help people find somebody if you remembered their face, but not their name. So we took, I think, 1,000 faces of people in our company, and we organized them in a little grid. And so you would look at 9 faces and say, okay, it's most like this person, and so on. And you would keep clicking and zooming in, and you would eventually find the person you wanted, even if you didn't remember their name.
One of the things that seems like it would be challenging here is that you actually don't know the similarities. All you get is a sort of relative similarity judgment. How do you turn that into something that can be used in a classical algorithm like multidimensional scaling?
Right. So your goal is to find an embedding so that the if you were looking for a if you're trying to predict the answers that you've observed on the data, you would be accurate. So that given 3 points, as I said, A, X, and Y. If someone said X is more like A than Y is, you would hope that the distance between X and A is smaller than the distance between Y and A. Of course, since people are answering probabilistically, you actually want a probabilistic model of this. But in general, you're trying to fit the data to that. Now, that's a highly non-convex problem, but you can still prove that certain algorithms will converge to the correct representation, even though it's a non-convex problem, assuming that the data is actually, assuming that people are answering the question according to some kind of probabilistic model of points embedded in space.
Now, a couple of episodes ago, we talked a little bit about active learning at kind of a high level. Right. Now, in this case, you could imagine that, for example, you put images in front of a user about which you're most uncertain about their judgment,
exactly.
For example. Is that the kind of way that you do the active learning?
Yeah, exactly. Let me give maybe a different example, which is related, and it'll make it more clear what's going on. So another representation besides this Euclidean embedding is a standard featural representation where you just have a bunch of features for the data. So if it's faces, for some types of objects like faces, we actually have great words in English to describe them, right? We have smiling, we have male, female, you know, eye color. We have words for smirk and we have words for dimples. We have everything. So faces are very amenable to a featural representation, something like maybe couches or sunglasses. There's something fonts would be hard to describe with features, and so those would be great for people to embed that way. But for faces, we just, for other data sets, what we do is we just put three, again, we do three triples, and we can prove mathematically why you want to put triples, but we put three of them in front of someone, and we say, what do two of them have in common? Give us a word that is common to two of them and not the third. And you can kind of prove, actually, it's like these kindergarten questions. Why do you ask what's common to two of them and not different from the third, as opposed to asking what does one of them have that's different from the other two? So it's kind of fun to relate this to something that you learn in kindergarten. But anyway, there, for example, that there becomes very clear. So if you give somebody three faces, most of the time they'll say, oh, two of them are a man and one is a woman, or two are a woman and one is a man, because if you have a balanced data set, then three quarters of the time it turns out that you'll have a mix of men and women. So active learning, what we do is we ask somebody, we get this feature, let's say male, we label our data according to that. So we use the crowd, actually, we just show them all the images. They're very quick at clicking on images. and then we can refrain from asking questions that we already know the answer to. So that enables us to, instead of getting three quarters of the time the same answer, male, female, you get new features, richer features, and more subtle features with many fewer questions. So you can prove theoretically that you have an exponential advantage, that you can learn the representation using many fewer questions. And in practice, it also happens that you can learn this representation with fewer questions.
A classic example of this kind of thing, do you remember the ESP game from Louis
yes.
Vuitton? So this is a game where you're trying to gather labels about images in a not so dissimilar way. And the game is played by two people are presented an image, and the objective is to assert words that are present in the image and to try to say the same thing, even though there's no other way of communicating. And so you go to this website, and you're paired with someone randomly out on the internet, and you're trying to describe the image using words in a way that that someone else might as well. And the trick to avoid this issue that you're describing is that you're presented with a blacklist over time of words that have previously been used to describe the image. And so if it's a picture if it's a picture of a man, then perhaps man would be one of the first things people would say, and then that would get blacklisted, and you'd have to sort of go deeper into this visual
right.
representation.
Right. So we had a fun example related to that. I love the ESP game work, by the way. It's really fun. What we did is we took a data set of sign language signs. So a man was signing all the signs in American Sign Language. He was more or less where it was a data set of video snips. And he was more or less wearing the same clothes in every snip. And so one image at a time, we did something very much like the ESP game, where we got a bunch of labels for each image, okay? And you could ask them to give more and more labels. And they would always, we took 10 images and we got essentially labels for all 10 of them from different people. And the labels were always, oh, it's a man, he has a beard, he's bald, he's wearing jeans. He's signing, so he's doing gesturing with his hands, he's doing something, he looks like Richard Lennon, or whatever. So anyway, he looks, and so you have all of these labels, and it turned out that all the labels we got applied equally well to all the images in the data set. So they weren't distinguishing images. So the interesting thing is that when you want to understand a data set as a whole, the relevant features are different than when you want to understand each image. Do you see what I mean? So the image labeling strategy of the ESP game, or crowdsourcing in general, is different when you want to understand the data set, and that's why these comparisons are very useful.
So how far can we take crowdsourcing in driving these kinds of representations? I mean, here when we're, just for everyone's sake, here when we're saying representations, we're talking about taking data and turning that into a vector of numbers, where the vector of numbers has some geometry that we can use to drive other machine learning type algorithms. And there's been a tremendous amount of success with sort of identifying, building representations for artifacts that are highly visual, that people can understand very quickly using the tremendous amount of brain that's dedicated to vision. Mm-hmm. But how far can we go? I mean, can we do better natural language processing? Can we look at at more structured kinds of data? Is there any hope of dealing with highly structured data that requires some kind of domain expertise? I mean, what's your vision for where to go with crowdsourcing?
Those are great questions. So some of the ideas are to use non-experts to see if they can still do expert tasks like diagnosing medical images. So that's a big open question, I think, in crowdsourcing, whether you can do that. people do very clever things with structures, as you're describing. So when humans are experts at vision, they can not only tell you what's in an image, but they can draw boxes around it. In one project, I forget exactly who did it, but what they did is they took pairs of images and they would have people match points. So if they were both churches, they would draw a line between the connecting the steeples of the two churches or crosses or something like that. And that can give the computer a very interesting representation because there's many different types of churches and there's many different points on them. So without even naming them, you can get into the fine-grained structure present in an image. I believe you could do the same with text as well. I don't see any reason why you couldn't. And I think that's a neat direction for crowdsourcing.
So one of the, so Adam, you have a tremendous range of interests. You've already hinted at just a few of these. I have the sense that you've also thought a little bit about how to, maybe I'm totally wrong here, but I feel like you've at least dabbled in sort of some of the econ CS type stuff that thinks about maybe like that would you would imagine would relate to how do we incentivize people in crowdsourcing situations to give us the right answer? How do we validate
there's a lot of work on that. And the ESP game is a fun one where they took what normally you pay people to do and they just made it actually fun for people to do. A lot of work in crowdsourcing is on quality control. So it's more about they do the work and you have to filter out people who are either not qualified to do it, or maybe they're watching TV and answering randomly, or maybe we definitely have run into people writing bots. so I've more worked on this from the practical side of how do you incentivize people to do it in a way that is socially acceptable. So it turns out that you can offer them prizes. You can say whoever does the best work will get paid, but people don't like that because they feel many people are then working and they're not getting paid anything and they get upset. So there's a lot of, there's the incentive structures that people seem to like, especially for these subjective tasks, which I do a lot, are ones where you say, okay, I will pay you a certain amount and then I will give you a bonus for doing more work. And typically we also limit the amount of work that any one person can do because people actually write programs to do. If you put out a large volume of work, people, and it's subjective, like who's more beautiful? I mean, we ask questions like that, and they know they can answer however they want. So we actually, just limit the amount that any one person can do so that hopefully they won't write programs. So it's kind of a practical thing. But to answer your question about the limits of crowdsourcing, we've had people do very interesting things like they can do the entire machine learning pipeline. So in machine learning, there's not just the representation, right? There's what else is there besides the representation? What would you say? What are the other steps of machine learning?
Right. There's modeling, regularization, right. Sort of choosing your inductive bias,
right.
Optimization or inference.
Exactly. So those we all have algorithms for, though. Those were experts in. What's the first step in a machine learning problem?
It's framing the problem.
Right, exactly. And choosing what problem you want to solve. So we said, can we get the crowd to help us choose a machine learning problem, okay, and ask a question, all right, and then get the data, and then label the data, choose the representation, and then we can run one of our many wonderful off-the-shelf classifiers. So that was a challenge. So just to understand what kind of things people can do, so we started by saying, okay, can you give us a good machine learning problem? Oh, here's some examples of binary classification. And people had no idea what we were asking. they just didn't make any sense to them, and we gave them examples. It didn't make any sense. Then we said, okay, let's play a game. Okay, let's invent a game. Guess blank from a picture of blank. And they really liked that, and they were very creative. And so they came up with ideas like, guess what color my eyes are from a picture of me with my eyes closed. Or guess whether I'm a man or a woman from a picture of my handwriting. Okay, and a lot of people suggested that. So then we were able to just ask them to give us data. So they just wrote on a piece of paper that, the quick brown fox jumped over the lazy dog. And then we had them take a picture of it with their camera, with their cell phone camera, email it to us, tell us whether they're man or woman. So very quickly we had a problem, we had data, we had them give us a representation as we just discussed, and then we could run a machine learning algorithm. So the crowd can really do the whole machine learning loop and we don't really need machine learning researchers anymore.
That's fantastic. So shifting gears just a little bit. So mm-hmm. One of the things that Adam, you've done that's been a tremendous service to machine learning has been organizing the New England Machine Learning Day.
Right.
So the New England Machine Learning Day is an event that's held at Microsoft Research New England and brings together machine learning researchers in the Boston area all the way up to sort of Dartmouth and down to Connecticut and Rhode Island. And it's kind of this really nice event that gets together people who are sort of, you know, in the area and interested in these topics, both in academia and industry, and sort of people who are generally interested. It's a lot of work for you to put this together, but it's a wonderful event, and so thanks for doing that. A few years ago at the New England Machine Learning Day, you gave a talk, and I'm trying to reconstruct this talk in my head, and so I'm hoping you'll sort of like elaborate on it, but you talked about the shapes of words.
Right. Well, first of all, Ryan's being modest. He's helped me organize this event over the last few years, which has been a great success.
Only in the tiniest amount, but
and it's been a lot of fun. We had great talks from numerous academics around, and the students come and they give wonderful poster presentations, and it's really a easy way for everyone to get together without having to fly to some conference. And for a lot of the students, it could be their first opportunity to see these kind of lectures, so they're really enjoying it. I did give a talk. I had a crazy idea, which I'm still working on. Actually, I the listeners, of course, can't see this, but my smartwatch that I'm wearing right now has a font that you guys won't be able to read at all. So if I get a text message,
wow,
here, you can't read that, and I can read it.
But you're certainly going to give us a photo of it that we can post on the website.
Sure. We have a paper on that, which is so we actually use crowdsourcing to try to design different letters for English, let's say, for the 26 letters of English. You know, they're thousands of years old, the Latin alphabet, and there's no reason that it's optimal for displaying on a smartwatch. So we did use crowdsourcing to help design possibly better letters that might be more readable. These letters that are on my watch are optimized so that I can read them without reading glasses. you could consider different criteria, and we compared how easy they are to learn. So we actually had people in crowdsourcing learning these new systems and how easily they could read them at various degrees of blur. So that's been a lot of fun, yeah. One of the things I'll mention, by the way, that it's a small thing, but one of the things that I've worked on that's related only because in organizing this event, there's a lot of boring kind of administrative work. And one of the things I've worked on in machine learning is programming by example. So when you kind of have to do an organizational task, anyone who has to do this knows that there's a lot of kind of manipulating of lists of names and things like that. And so one of the things I'm interested in is programming by example, where you can get a computer to do something by giving examples rather than programming. So if you have a list of names and you want to sort them by last name, or if you want to count how many times a certain name appears in a list or various things, we have these systems for manipulating text by example. Those systems are using machine learning typically and artificial intelligence.
So how do these things work? So what's a use case of this like in practice? So is maybe, you know, you're editing a spreadsheet in Excel, for example.
Right. So there is actually Excel has a feature like that built in already. People really like it, but any kind of text processing, that's what our system was designed for, is large quantities of unstructured text or semi-structured text that you want to manipulate by example. You might have a bunch of names and addresses in a file, or you might have a log file. More generally, I'm very interested in the question of how computers can synthesize programs. So most of what happens in machine learning is, you know, learning continuous functions, optimizing functions. But here, when you want to learn a program, that's a very difficult space to search through, right? How do you represent a program? That's very challenging. And so it's a totally different kind of search problem, which is what one of the challenges that I really enjoyed. And there's not very much work in that area. But I do think that once computers can generate programs and they can possibly sort of output things, they can, you know, it's a small step in the progress towards the self-improving algorithms where computers can get smarter and take over the world.
So, I mean, there is this area of program induction, right? That is
right.
That is trying to tackle this. And there's been a little bit of work actually by Josh Tenenbaum and some of his students. And I was actually involved in some of this too. What I think makes program induction hard is coming up with an inductive bias that makes sense for programs. That is to say, what makes one program more sort of parsimonious, given that they can both do the same thing, maybe, or both of them are sort of reasonable explanations of a map between, you know, from input to output, or maybe just producing an output? How do you make it clear what which one of these is kind of simpler and more interesting? So do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah,
this
so that so there's, I think there's really two sides to the program generation problem. So if I have data, let's just be concrete, right? I have a list of names. I have Adam Kalai, Catherine Gorham, and Ryan Adams. That's the input. That's X. The output is Y. It's sorted by last name, so it's Ryan Adams, Catherine Gorham, Adam Kalai. Now we're looking for a function that maps that input to the output. One of them is sort by the second word, sort each line, you know, by the second word. One of them is just output the fixed string Y, no matter what the input is. And that's not probably not what we were looking for. If we give other names, we don't want the same output. So the problem of ranking functions, if you have a number of functions, right, and you're trying to, a number of programs described somehow, and we haven't gotten into the representation, but if you have them and you want to rank them, that's an interesting problem. That falls a little bit more classically into the structured prediction domain. So you can put weights on functions, and then you try to learn, which functions are more likely than others. Another and perhaps more challenging part is finding the program in the first place. So if the program is pretty complicated, if you're counting things, you can involve many steps. So finding the program in the first place is even more challenging than ranking them. And so that's an exponential search problem because there's a lot of programs out there. On the other hand, computers are very fast. And since there hasn't been a ton of work on that, there's actually a lot of opportunity to improve it. So I think starting with these simple problems, fairly simple problems, where you feel like, gee, a computer really should be able to do this for me. In today's day and age, I shouldn't have to write a program to do that. The computer should understand what I want. And they can almost do it by brute force search. We can really expand the horizon of what we're able to do using computers by doing a smarter search. So for example, in the sorting one, there's many functions out there. Let's say you already know that sorting is a possibility, but there's other things you could do with text, right? So there's a clue here that one might be a sort of the other is that if you look at the letters in the input and the output, they're a permutation of one another. So this number of A's and B's and C's in both X and Y in the example I gave are the same. So you know that the input is the output is a permutation of the input. Maybe sorting is more useful. So as you do your search, you might be biased towards including the sorting function. And if you were manipulating dates and you had days of the week in the input and output, that would be a suggestion that maybe you should use some kind of date functions. So you can do a more intelligent search in our work that seemed to really make the difference between, that seemed to expand largely the set of functions you could search through in a reasonable amount of time.
Sort of giving it hints about what kinds of functions might exist.
Right.
Because this gets at something that I think in its full generality I found to be very frustrating about thinking about program induction, which is relative to continuous problems, you don't really get partial credit, mm-hmm. right? So if you're close to if a human would think that what you produced was close to the right answer, but your loss function somehow doesn't know about that, then it's very hard to navigate the space. So let me give an example. So in the sorting case, mm-hmm. imagine that we had 100 names instead of three names, and and we're going to be scored, for example, based on whether or not we got the right position for every name, and we accidentally, when we learned our program, took the person who should be last and put them first.
Right.
And so now this list, by our sort of human judgment, is almost sorted. It's like very close to the right answer, but if we, for example, scored it according to whether or not I got the right position for each name, then it's completely wrong. Every single name is wrong because there's this one thing that appeared at the top and shifted everyone else down.
Right.
So it sounds like what you're doing is a really interesting sort of angle on that, because you're basically saying, well, I know about the concept of permutations, and now I can reason about what it means for a permutation to be similar, in which that's kind of, very close to the right permutation.
I completely agree that it's a very hard problem because you don't have like you say, partial credit. So if your program is close, it could give a completely wrong answer. If you take a program, anyone who's ever written a program, or even if you haven't, you can imagine if you take a program and change one function in the program a little bit, the output can change tremendously. So you have to really use some higher level thinking to solve it, and it's very different than the kind of convex optimization problems that we typically face.
Do you feel like there's any hope of a kind of a unifying principle here where we say there's certain classes of functions that you can represent, things like dates and names and ordering? You know, we can build in a lot of domain knowledge, but, you know, the hope is to get good at this sort of in general, but suddenly it feels like it sort of feels impossible. Is there an intermediate sort of middle ground?
Yeah, I hope so. I think that what we were playing with was something a little more intelligent than brute force search. And I think a lot, actually thinking about how we as humans solve problems is very helpful. So we do solve these problems. We collected our data from help forums online where people ask programmers, how do I do this? They might be programmers actually asking one another, and they always gave examples. They insisted on examples. So here's my question, give me an example. And then I would give an example, and then somebody would send back, here's a program. And, you know, when we think about how does a person look at these lists and understand those things, we do solve that problem in some way. It's not a convex optimization, and I think we are using these kind of clues to do a more intelligent search, but it's quite a complicated search problem because we must have some internal notion of partial progress, which I don't think we've got a handle on, but I think it's an exciting area because it's an interesting problem and it's already almost useful in its own right, so that's when you can really make progress on the problem.
Adam Kalai of Microsoft Research New England. Really interesting stuff. I'm going to go sign up for a Mechanical Turk account right now.
Every time I talk to Adam, I feel like he just has incredibly insightful and creative things to say. And I really love his work. I love the breadth of it and the energy that he brings to everything he does. He's such a pleasure.
Well, that's it for us this week. I'm Catherine Gorman.
And I'm Ryan Adams.
Tune in next episode. Support for this episode of Talking Machines comes from Baidu Research. Talking Machines is an original production of Tote Bag Productions. Our theme music was composed by John Ferrati. Our logo was designed by Alex Wilchko and arranged by Mike Rohr. Want to get in touch with us? TheTalkingMachines.com or TheTalkingMachines@gmail.com. Interested in a job you've heard about on our show? Email us at jobs@TheTalkingMachines.com.